All right. So this might be a little bit of a, I don't know, this might expose some of the generation gaps that we might have in the room here. But does anybody remember when they got their first microwave oven? Do you guys remember when your first microwave oven came out? Do you remember that? Does anybody remember when cable television first came on the scene? You guys remember cable when it first came online, cable television? Yeah, it's dial-up internet. Or maybe, you know, maybe fast-forwarding to when cell phone or mobile phones, or actually really car phones. Anybody ever have the installed, like, in the floorboard of your car kind of phone? That was my first.
I remember when radio came online.
You remember when radio came online. So, yeah, we're really exposing the generation gaps. Or TV, get your first TV. But, you know, as you think about these emerging technologies, these various forms of household appliance that help us kind of just do what we do on a daily basis, whether it's prepare food or communicate or enjoy entertainment or whatever it might be, if you look at it from one particular angle, and this is obviously no profound insight, I mean, we all know this, and, you know, voluminous articles and, you know, books probably have been written on these kinds of things, sociological studies and all that. But it's not hard to recognize that a lot of these things really condition us for convenience. They really sort of shape our minds around rapid delivery, around sort of ease and comfort. If you just think about what the industrial revolution did and then the technological revolution has done and continues to do, it really does condition us as human beings to desire and even feel like we need convenience. We need comfort. And the way that you can tell that is when you have it taken away from you for any moment in time. When your air conditioner goes out. You know, when, I mean, you know, there wasn't always central heating and cooling. We all know that, right? I mean, that's not like some, you know, it wasn't here in the Garden of Eden, although it was probably more natural climate. Anyway, it's a whole other deal. But the fact of the matter is that you can see this, you can experience this when you experience the absence of these things. These things they go away. If you've ever misplaced your cell phone, for example, or something like that, you know, you're like, you're kind of a little bit of a panic sets in. You know, how are people going to reach me? How am I going to reach people? I'm totally disconnected from the rest of the entire world. You know, you have these sort of these momentary feelings of sort of lostness, if you will, or discomfort, or even frustration and irritation, right? How many of you have ever had the thought, and I think that this is an appropriate thought, in fact, I think this could be even an inspired, even godly thought, to wonder and continue to wonder and continue to press in on this fact as, and that's this, with all of the advancements and all the technological accomplishments, everything that we know and experience in a modern society, why on earth do we still have to experience so much traffic all the time? You'd think that they'd just figure out that problem and solve it, right? But even in those kinds of experiences where we experience some kind of gridlock on the highway or on some side street or construction or whatever, and things just come to a screeching halt, especially when it's not supposed to happen, have you ever been traveling at a particular time on a freeway? And it's like, you know, a Saturday morning at like 6 a.m, and you just know that there should not be any traffic, and all of a sudden there's something that's occurred somewhere, you know, miles down the road, and there's traffic, and it's maddening. It's frustrating. Well, at least it is for, I can tell it is for you guys. For me, I'm usually pretty patient with that kind of stuff. But the bottom line is that we are, like I said, we are oriented toward convenience, toward ease, toward comfort. And in fact, as we know, that's not life in a fallen world in reality. That's really not how we grow as the people of God, as individual Christians, nor how we really grow in fellowship and in relationship with one another. This whole idea of sort of entitlement to comfort and ease, it plays itself out really in the current studies that have been done. Just a particular article I'll give you as a point of reference. This is from the Daily Mail. It was written in May of 2013, so it's fairly recent. The headline of this is young people want everything but can't be bothered to earn it as fantasy gap, they call it, between actual earnings and expectations widens among graduates. That's the headline. Research into the life goals of three generations of students shows teenagers are more driven by materialism than ever. But the numbers don't add up, as 62% want to have money, but 39% don't want to work for it. That's an interesting conflict right there, isn't it? Life goals of 355,000 students surveyed in the U.S. show a shift in priorities. So this is a massive, long-term survey and study that was done of 355,000 students. It examined the priorities of these 355,000 students between the years of 1976 and 2007. So we're talking like this long, multi-generational kind of study. And here's what the trends indicate. Modern young people, they want all the cash and the flashy lifestyles, but young people just aren't prepared to work hard to achieve it. Today's teenagers have a greater sense of entitlement than previous generations, according to new research. Studies show that teenagers are more materialistic than ever, while the desire to work hard is at an all-time low. A survey into the life goals of three generations of students reveal a fantasy gap between the desire for wealth and the desire to work. Professor Jean Twenge, who led the research, said there is a generational increase in narcissism and entitlement. The professor from San Diego State University said, quote, compared to previous generations, recent high school graduates are more likely to want lots of money and nice things, but less likely to say they're willing to work hard to earn them, end quote. 69% of recent high school graduates said they want to own their own home. Only 55%, though, back in 1976. Similarly, 62% of current students think having a lot of money is important, compared to 48% who thought that 30 years ago. Research showed teenagers are driven by materialism more than previous generations, as I said. Meanwhile, willingness to work hard is lower than before, with 39% of students in 2005 to 2007 saying they didn't want to work hard. Only a quarter of students admitted this back in 1976. Professor Twenge, now here's the conclusion, and I always find this interesting. You have these research studies that are done, and the practices that they employ to derive the research content or the data are usually pretty good and pretty solid. It's just that the conclusions that they often draw are a little bit off, I think. So this particular professor over this study drew some conclusions that I thought are, again, identifying what is more symptom than actual core problem. But this professor, Professor Twenge, said this, that the current culture of advertising has changed young people's goals. His research found that adolescents' materialism was highest when more was being spent on advertising. This suggests that advertising may play a crucial role in the development of youth materialism. It also might explain the gap between materialism and the work ethic, as advertising rarely shows the work necessary to earn the money necessary to pay for the advertised products. When family life, this is a quote from the professor, when family life and economic conditions are unstable, youth may turn to material things for comfort. And when our society funds large amounts of advertising, youth are more likely to believe that the good life is the goods life. So this particular study, while it points out this decline in work ethic and this increase in sort of entitlement, like I want the stuff, I just don't want to have to work for the stuff kind of mindset, it kind of blames it on some kind of external stimuli as opposed to some core, you know, internal issue, which is always, you know, kind of problematic when you're talking about human life and human activity and human decision making. When you come to Proverbs 2, we're going to study Proverbs 2 today, you see this whole idea clashing. Once again, every time we come to this, we're kind of clashing with trends in our modern culture. This clash against this idea of entitlement or a lack of desire to really work hard at achieving something. And Proverbs 2 really puts a fine point on that. Just a little overview of the chapter before we kind of step into it. This is a return in chapter 2 to this more intimate, direct counsel of a father to his son. You recall last week we looked at the end of chapter 1, which really was wisdom personified and sort of making an appeal and a call, a public call in the streets and in the marketplace. This returns us back to what we saw early in chapter 1, this intimate counsel of a father to his son. It's interesting to note that in the Hebrew, this entire chapter is one complex sentence. It's one sentence in the Hebrew, but its structure is very clear, it's very balanced, and it's very logical. Each of the 22 verses in chapter 1, they comprise what one commentator calls an alphabetic poem. Sometimes they're called an acrostic. This is not a pure acrostic. An acrostic would be that sort of every line or every verse begins with a letter of the Hebrew alphabet. This is a variant of that in which each of the first 11 lines or 11 verses in the chapter begin with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and the second half, or verses 12 or lines 12 through 22, they all begin with the first letter of the second half of the Hebrew alphabet. So it's a little bit of a variant of that sort of straightforward acrostic where each line starts with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet. But it's an interesting structure in the Hebrew. It's also divided very clearly thematically between the first half and the second half. The first 11 verses in chapter 2 really deal with the development or the production of the son's character, the development of wisdom in the son and the production of that wisdom in the life of the son. And then verses 12 to 22, or the exact second half of this chapter, is on the deliverance or protection from the wicked man or the wicked woman. So the first one focuses on development, and the second half focuses on this idea of deliverance. So let's read the chapter together. Again, we're going to try to sweep through the entire chapter today. Obviously, most of our focus will probably center on the first part because there are themes in the second part that either we've talked about a little bit before and also we're going to talk about in more detail in subsequent chapters. But let's just read the whole chapter and as a whole as it's kind of written, and then we'll begin our study and looking a little more closely at it. Chapter 2, verse 1, "My son, if you receive my words and treasure up my commandments with you, making your ear attentive to wisdom and inclining your heart to understanding, yes, if you call out for insight and raise your voice for understanding, if you seek it like silver and search for it as for hidden treasure, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth come knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to those who walk in integrity, guarding the paths of justice and watching over the way of his saints. Then you will understand righteousness and justice and equity, every good path. For wisdom will come into your heart and knowledge will be pleasant to your soul. Discretion will watch over you. Understanding will guard you, delivering you from the way of evil, from men of perverted speech, who forsake the paths of uprightness to walk in the ways of darkness, who rejoice in doing evil and delight in the perverseness of evil, men whose paths are crooked and who are devious in their ways. So you will be delivered from the forbidden woman, from the adulteress with her smooth words, who forsakes the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. For her house sinks down to death and her paths to the departed. None who go to her come back, nor do they regain the paths of life. So you will walk in the way of the good and keep to the paths of the righteous. For the upright will inhabit the land, and those with integrity will remain in it. But the wicked will be cut off from the land, and the treacherous will be rooted out of it." So in this section, or actually this entire chapter, again, returning to this counsel of a father to his sons, right out of the gate, you see this father's really bold promise, this really bold sort of announcement, and it's kind of an attached promise, but it presupposes this father's absolutely settled conviction. So let's look at this a little bit. He says, my words and my commandments are, he equates those two things with wisdom, understanding, the fear of the Lord, and the knowledge of God. He is basically saying, if you listen to my words, and if you treasure up my commandments within you, and then in the second verse, he begins to equate his words and his commandments with wisdom and with understanding and with insight. There's this equating of those ideas. Now what you see, though, and that's in the first five verses, but what you see in verses 6-8 is this full deference that the Father gives to the true source of wisdom and knowledge, the true source of understanding. The Father bases his authority not on his patriarchal position nor on tradition, but on the Lord himself. So there's this bold promise, but it totally presupposes what is a settled conviction in the heart and mind of the Father, namely that the true source of wisdom is not his words, it's not his commandments, but it's to the extent that his words and his commandments are a direct reflection of the will and purpose and words of the Lord himself, the heart and mind of God himself. This is, to me, again, as even though this is framed up as a father's instruction to a son, I find it tremendously helpful and encouraging and even convicting to me as a father before I even think about instructing my own son because of what this necessarily requires. For any of us who are parents, to be effective in our instruction of children and fulfilling this mandate of passing on wisdom to the next generation, for us to be effective in that, it presupposes that we are immersed ourselves in the source of wisdom, and that's God himself. And I think that this, in a way, in sort of an implicit kind of way, it really sort of highlights how frequent parental instruction or discipline can be more oriented towards self-centered motivations or can be more oriented towards self-centered outcomes as opposed to what it should be centered on. Let me just kind of build that out a little bit. Oftentimes, and if I don't think I'm alone in this, but maybe I am. Maybe this is just confession time for me. But I think as parents, it's not uncommon for us to err on the side of leveling out discipline or correction of some kind because we do not want to be inconvenienced. We don't want to be irritated by our kids. We don't want to be embarrassed by their behavior. We don't want what we're doing or our lives to be interrupted by them or by their immaturity or their misbehavior or their disobedience. So because of that, we correct and we redirect and we tell them, don't do that, do this. And in reality, if we're just really gut level honest, if we are just sort of standing before a holy God completely exposed, we have to be honest that oftentimes our motivations in that instruction and in that quote unquote counsel, it's motivated by real self-interest. Our correction is motivated by a self-interest, and that is that we don't want to be inconvenienced. We don't want to be irritated. We don't want to be embarrassed by our child's bad behavior. Or another angle on this is that we might be instructing our children and trying to guide them and shepherd them in a particular direction because the outcome that we seek for them is for them to make us proud and make us look good as parents. So we're guiding them and leading them and counseling them and encouraging them in a particular direction. And really the motivation is not just that we want them to be healthy, wealthy, and wise, but that we want to look good, that we want the spotlight to come back on us and for people to say to us, man, you guys have done a great job with that kid. The fact of the matter is, though, the driving motivation for us as parents, and this first section here in chapter 2 spotlights that. It everything that we do and say as parents should be motivated by this one singular objective we find in verse 5, that our children will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. That, to me, is one of the great challenges of seeking to be a faithful parent, is for us to set aside our own selfish tendencies as parents, our own self-centeredness, our own fleshly desires, and have our motives and what is at the heart of our instruction and the heart of our counsel be that our children will truly understand and know God.
And isn't it interesting that fear and knowledge go together?
Yes, as it does throughout this book. Yeah, I started looking a little bit at that. I didn't get very far, but I'm really fascinated by the contrast.
You go back to Exodus, and is how many wives? 700?
Yeah, Ecclesiastes, it was just like, you know, replete with folly.
It's been the downfall of men since Adam and Eve.
What is it with these women, man? Seriously. That's right. Well, so just kind of moving on from that just initial sort of admonition to any of us who are parents to recognize that the real goal of parenting is this goal that our children will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God, not to be motivated by self-centeredness or some kind of outcome that would make us look good. We turn now to the real sort of heart of the passage, the heart of the verses here. And we see in the first four verses these conditions for gaining wisdom. I'll just read it to you again. My son, if you receive my words and treasure up my commandments within you, making your ear attentive to wisdom and inclining your heart to understanding, yes, if you call out for insight and raise your voice for understanding, if you seek it like silver and search for it as for hidden treasure. So you have the setup of an if-then scenario here. In this first section, it's saying, here are the conditions. Here's what's required for gaining wisdom. And you see there at the beginning, this idea of receiving my words or accepting my words. There's this condition of acceptability or receptivity, being accepting of the Father's words. This really lays the foundation for all the other conditions, that there is this inner submission. This inner submission of the heart and the mind of the child to be submitted to the wisdom of God that's being transmitted through the Father. There's an inner acceptance of it, an inner submission to that wisdom that's coming and receiving those words, truly receiving them with a heart of humility. And this really sort of marks out this core commitment that's involved here. As I said in sort of the introductory material, you know, we are more oriented toward convenience and comfort than we are toward conviction and commitment. But this requires true conviction and true commitment if we are to gain wisdom. And this really, this initial statement, this initial condition of being one who receives or accepts the words of the Father, the wisdom from God coming through the Father, is that initial foundational condition. It's a humble acceptance. From Bruce Waltke's commentary, he says it like this: the condition entails commitment. The philosopher of science, Michael Polanyi, argues that true knowledge flows from personal commitment to a set of particulars as tools or clues to shape a skillful achievement, not from detached observation of them. This way of knowing requires skill. For example, one knows, discovers, learns, and experiences the skill of riding a bicycle by committing oneself to it, taking a risk, and using skillful actions, not by acquiring facts about a bicycle. So this idea of willful acceptance, willful receptivity to the counsel requires a level of commitment to the process of growing and learning in wisdom, in the application of it, applying the skills of wisdom in life, being receptive to those words and then application and receiving and applying. So the Father here, the implication here is that the Father, this wise Father, knows that this idea of persistent forced submission does not ultimately produce in the Son a true and lasting wisdom. Remember, we talked about this last week. I mean, the objective is not just that small children grow up to be adults who just have a really clear, healthy understanding of submission to authority. No, it's that they grow and mature, and as they grow and mature, they understand that submission to authority leads to wise actions, and wise actions and wise thinking leads to reward that's sustained. And so the father recognizes this too. There must be an internal commitment on the part of the son, this bending of the son's will toward genuine receptivity and acceptance of his father's words of counsel and instruction. So the first condition is sort of a foundational condition of being receptive, accepting these words willfully, humbly. Well, you'll notice as we continue to go on that these conditions, they kind of escalate in their intensity. The next one you see here is this receptivity or acceptance, it kind of escalates, and it escalates into what is called treasuring, or treasure up my commandments within you. So this is the idea of storing up or hiding or concealing for some future purpose. Psalm 119:11 uses the same term here. I have hidden, or I have stored up your word in my heart that I might not sin against you. So there's this active, really, the one commentator called it to memorize with religious affection. So you have this receptivity and this acceptance, but it goes beyond that to storing it up, to treasuring it, to hiding it, to making it a part of your vocabulary and your thought process, these words. It's like rote memory of truth. You're storing it up because it's going to serve a purpose in the future. In the same way that the psalmist would articulate this storing up of the word of God so that he might not sin. It's a similar idea. But again, another condition, and it continues to move forward. Making your ear attentive to wisdom and inclining your heart to understanding. So you have increasing initiative here. There's this acceptance or receptivity to this active storing it up, memorizing it, meditating upon these words, thinking about it, contemplating it for greater understanding, for more timely application. And then the initiative continues to escalate with this attentiveness and this inclination of the heart toward wisdom and understanding. The idea of paying attention or having an ear that's attentive to wisdom, it has with it the idea of not just hearing something, but hearing and doing. It implies the carrying out of the thing, not just the hearing of it. If you just imagine a drill sergeant getting all up in a private's face and saying, "Private, did you hear what I said?" The drill sergeant is not asking the private if they just heard the words. He's really asking, "Why have you not done what I commanded you to do?" It's the same idea here. This idea of being attentive to wisdom means the hearing and the doing. In the same way you see in James, don't merely be hearers of the word, but be doers also. Same kind of idea here. It's not just hearing it, having it wash over your ear canal, but it's actually the hearing and the doing and being attentive to it, paying attention to it so that you can flesh it out actively and precisely and consistently. And then inclining your heart to understanding moves it even further in that there is this intentional, persistent focus, an increasing desire for understanding. And so it's sort of this consistent recommitment of the heart, inclining your heart toward understanding. And you'll notice that as this continues to move forward, there's increased engagement and effort that's required here. And oftentimes what happens to us when we find ourselves failing to live wisely, or when we find ourselves going through seasons where we aren't really growing, we aren't really living the life that God has called us to, we find ourselves seemingly stumbling, whether by virtue of our actions or the way that we're thinking, or we get turned in on ourselves, whatever it might be, you can clearly probably look at your own life and recognize that the level of initiative that you are undertaking in these these conditions of gaining wisdom are probably depleted. They're probably lacking. Because this all is moving toward increased effort, increased initiative. So listening that implies doing, and bending your heart with focused intentionality toward desiring to understand wisdom, desiring to understand what the right path is, what the right thing to do is, what the will of the Lord is. And as I said, this increase in initiative, it really gets more aggressive. There's more aggression and passion in these conditions as we continue to move forward. And in fact, verse 3 marks a real escalation of this. You go from what is somewhat of a passive reception of wisdom to what is really more of an aggressive quest for it. You look at verse 3, it says, if you call out for insight and raise your voice for understanding. So you've got now this passionate appeal. There is a verbal, aggressive, passionate appeal, calling out for it, raising your voice for understanding. This could likely be equated to the person who just is praying for and asking God to help them understand, to give them wisdom and insight into matters that are perplexing, to help them understand how to apply the scriptures to a particular difficult matter. It's this appeal for God to give them understanding, to give them wisdom, calling out for it in passionate appeal. You turn to James, which James is a New Testament book of wisdom literature, if you will. In James chapter 1, verses 2 through 8, you have this very well-known passage of Scripture on how we are to handle or respond to the various trials of life. But it also talks about wisdom in this context. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, let him appeal to God, let him cry out to God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith, with no doubting. For the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. You have the same idea. We're not talking about some sort of magical statement that you can just speak to the Lord so that it will open up the floodgates of wisdom, right? We're talking about a person who is going through various trials, who is walking through difficulty and walking through challenge and walking through heaviness, and they're having to learn to persevere and to be steadfast through that. And there's this commitment that if you ask for wisdom with sincerity, with genuine passion and conviction, not being double-minded, not lacking the faith that is required to walk through these trials with the hope that comes to those who are in Christ, you ask for it and God gives you wisdom, even when you're perplexed, even in the midst of walking through struggle or challenge. And that's the idea that we see here in Proverbs chapter 2, in this calling out for it, this crying out for it, this appealing for it. Again, it's important for us to not detach these conditions from one another, or not detach them from the overall pursuit of wisdom and what's required for it. And I think that that's where another sort of foolish endeavor of those of us when we're not thinking clearly, we get into a bind or we're going through a difficult time, and all we're doing is just begging God to help us and give us strength and give us wisdom, but we're not doing the other things that we're called to do. We're stymied in other areas of our spiritual life. We're not being faithful in other areas of our spiritual life. And so all we're doing is just appealing for wisdom, and we're not applying the things that we know right now in faithfulness and obedience. And so there's a little bit of a warning here as well. It's not just getting desperate, getting into a difficult spot, and then just starting to cry out, God, give me wisdom, God, give me wisdom. But there is a level of passion and conviction that's associated with this as this quest for wisdom continues. Well, it goes on, and you see here in verse 4, if you seek it like silver and search for it as for hidden treasure, you see this recognition of wisdom's value and how it affects someone's drive and determination toward acquiring it. It equates the value of wisdom and understanding to that of silver or hidden treasure. And the injunction to the son is to seek it as such, to pursue it, to see the value of it as though it's treasure, as though it's silver, something of high value or worth. And so your drive and your determination to pursue it is determined by that clear recognition of its intrinsic value. Again, it's a quest, and it's causing effort and initiative on the part of the pursuer. That's the counsel of the Father to the Son. Well, then, after these conditions are laid out, you see the outcome when these conditions are met. Verses 5 to 11, "Then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth come knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to those who walk in integrity, guarding the paths of justice and watching over the way of his saints. Then you will understand righteousness and justice and equity, every good path. For wisdom will come into your heart, and knowledge will be pleasant to your soul. Discretion will watch over you. Understanding will guard you." So you first of all see this relationship with God that comes as a result of this meeting these conditions, of pursuing it, of calling for it, of being receptive to the words and the counsel of the wise, of crying out for it in desperate prayer, and having a quest for it like it's treasure. You fulfill these conditions, and it results in this relationship with God that's based upon true knowledge. It's based upon the true knowledge and fear of the Lord. It's not trite, it's not simplistic, it's not surface, it's not excessively emotive, it's true knowledge of God, the knowledge of God and the fear of the Lord. And that's the outcome of this kind of pursuit, meeting these kinds of conditions in our pursuit of wisdom. And again, going back to the Father's instruction, this is the ultimate aim of parenting too for our children. Not that they would have easy, quick answers to life's challenges that they can just sort of, you know, click off, but that they would know God. That they would know God in his truest sense and who he truly is, according to his word and how he's revealed himself to us. What we oftentimes see in our lives and the lives of those we might know in our families, those we might be in some type of counseling, discipleship relationship with, is this inclination to know God, but it's really a God of their own making or convenience. In other words, if our desire to know God is centered on a God that is characterized in this narrow span of characteristics that appeal to us, that we feel like will be a balm to our aching soul, instead of really a true knowledge of God and the fear of the Lord that is really taking in the totality of God and his majesty and his greatness and his kindness and his grace and his love and his judgment and his wrath and his holiness. I mean, the full scope and span of who God is. That is the objective of this pursuit of wisdom, and that is the outcome if these conditions are met consistently. You also have the protection of God. Verses 7 to 8 says, "He stores up sound wisdom for the upright, and he is a shield to those who walk in integrity, guarding the paths of justice and watching over the way of his saints." There is a protective outcome here. Wisdom brings about the protection of God. It protects us from harm. It protects us from evil. It protects us from falling by the way. It guards us in our paths. It guards us in our walk. It helps us to walk in justice. So you have these protective terms of shielding and guarding and watching over. So there's a protection that's implicit here. You also have this outcome of a life of righteousness, justice, and equity in verse 9. "Then you will understand righteousness and justice and equity, every good path." This is a picture of the actual walking, living life of the Son And it's a life that is characterized by righteousness, justice, and equity. And again, you go back to the last section that we looked at and how wisdom's calling out in the streets. And we talked about how wisdom has implications and application that is pervasive. It's ubiquitous. It applies in the public square. It implies in the marketplace. It applies in our families, in our homes. It has broad-based application and importance. Well, the person who is walking in wisdom, who is pursuing wisdom in these kinds of ways with intentionality and conviction and passion and effort, it results in a life that is characterized by righteousness, by justice, by equity, that you will be known as someone who is fair, who is just, who is wise in their counsel, who has discernment. Even in the most basic decisions of life, there's a standard of life, there's a characteristic of that person's life that is putting these kinds of qualities on display, righteousness, justice, equity, in a profound way. Another outcome is that you have a peaceful and contented soul. We talked about this a little bit last week because you have at the end of that section from last week this idea of not fearing dread of disaster, of being strong and solid and sound. Well, here in verse 10, for wisdom will come into your heart and knowledge will be pleasant to your soul. There's a peaceableness. There is a contentedness, there is a settledness that accompanies wisdom. And then finally, there will be wisdom serves as a safeguard of wise living. In verse 11, discretion will watch over you. Again, terms of protection. Understanding will guard you. So it is a safeguard for the way that we live our lives. It's God's protection, but it's also the net effect of walking in the ways of God that just by consequence or by outcome serves as a protection. It's a safeguard.
Notice that knowledge doesn't do that. Wisdom doesn't put knowledge in. Wisdom goes into your, knowledge goes into your brain, but wisdom comes out from your heart and what you actually do.
The faithful application of knowledge, yes, is wisdom, for sure. Well, finally, and we'll kind of wrap up with this, and again, as I said, there's more sections that we're going to deal with these kinds of characters that are in the path to thwart us from being wise. But you have this deliverance or protection from the wicked man and the wicked woman in verses 12 to 22. Verse 12, delivering you from the way of the evil men, the way of evil, from men of perverted speech, who forsake the paths of uprightness to walk in the ways of darkness, who rejoice in doing evil and delight in the perverseness of evil, men whose paths are crooked and who are devious in their ways. So you will be delivered from the forbidden woman, from the adulteress with her smooth words, who forsakes the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. For her house sinks down to death and her paths to the departed. None who go to her come back, nor do they regain the paths of life. So you will walk in the way of the good and keep the paths of the righteous. For the upright will inhabit the land, and those with integrity will remain in it. But the wicked will be cut off from the land, and the treacherous will be rooted out of it. You have this picture of the wicked man who has perverted speech and who is devious, who devises evil, and the wicked woman who is a temptress or a seductress or an adulteress, and quite prominent metaphor, particularly in the instruction of a young man, to be wary of the wicked man who would lead them into devious ways, and the adulterous woman who, with her smooth words, would lead you into a path of seductive sinfulness. And both of these have this characterization of darkness, of deception, and of ultimate death. That's the imagery that you see surrounding these two types of people. And so this pursuit of wisdom is a protection or a safeguard from the influence of the wicked man and the wicked woman. We have to live and breathe and walk and interact and have relationship to one degree or another with people of all types, right? We have to relate to and have some type of interaction with people who might very well be devious. Men in the workplace, we have to interact with women who might very well be characterized as a seductress woman, someone who would be at a moment's notice inclined toward tempting you to fall into sin. All the time, we're having to do that. And we need to be able to do that in a way that is strong and faithful and impactful in a lost culture. And the way that we do that, the way that we safeguard against being led astray by our interactions with a fallen world, is by passionately, consistently, determinedly pursuing wisdom like its treasure, with a very open and receptive heart to the counsel of the wise, with such a desire and a passion for it that we will plead for it when we're perplexed, that we'll call out for it with a loud voice in our effort to obtain understanding and to heed wise counsel. And as a result, we will know God, and we will know His protection, we will know peace, we will know contentment, and we will be guarded from the deception and the allurements of wicked people. That's what's in it for us if we are to pursue the true wisdom of God. Any final thoughts before we pray?
It just seems to me wisdom requires diligent search, but ultimately God is the one who gives it.
Absolutely.
So he's willing, but we have to do our part.
That's right. It's just like Jeremiah when he was speaking to the people who were in captivity, the Jews who were in captivity, and he was calling them out, basically, and he says that the Lord says that you will seek me and you will find me when you seek me with all of your heart. I will show myself to you, and you will seek me and you will find me when you seek me with all of your heart. There is a holy sweat involved in walking with God and knowing God, right? And that's the same principle here in terms of pursuing wisdom.
Mm-hmm. And that was his downfall. These women that he kept marrying,
yeah,
that turned into idolatry.
Yeah. Yeah, the corrupting influence of false worship and the interplay of seductive behavior and sensuality and all that.
For all his wisdom, he was still a human being.
Yeah. Let's pray. We'll be dismissed.